Okay, hello everyone, and in this episode of the Tom Ritchie Podcast, I am honored to have a guest. I have Robert Marshall from Reading Through History, and Robert and I were talking over the weekend about World War I and the legacies and all of that, and of course, I am recording this for the podcast, but we will be streaming this as well on YouTube. So everybody, just remember, if you like what Robert is saying, whether you're listening to the podcast or you're watching the live recording on YouTube, make sure to go to Robert's channel, which is Reading Through History. If you just type in Reading Through History, and he is knocking on the door of 20,000 YouTube subscribers. We want to make sure that we get him those. All right, so let's make sure he's got 20K once we're finished with our broadcast. And so today is Veterans Day in the United States, but we also call it internationally known as Armistice Day. And of course, this was the original significance of the day, and I saw that President Trump is in France, or was in France today, with a lot of European and world leaders. You saw the President of France, the Chancellor of Germany, President Trump, lots of other world leaders today at the ceremonies. And so the thing is, though, that World War I really doesn't get a lot of attention. There have been times when I've asked my students, what are the three most important wars in United States history? And typically, you know, they'll rank differently, but I think the consensus... Oh, go ahead. Yeah, go ahead, Robert.
They will say the American Revolution, the Civil War, and World War II.
Exactly. Well, yeah, and it's so predictable. Anybody who teaches history, and of course, it's not just the students, it's what we're teaching them. We're teaching them that these are the three most important wars. Now, I'm not saying that they're not. I think that they're certainly important wars, but I think that a lot of times World War I gets forgotten, especially as an American war. I think it's something that I emphasize more in my European history classes than in my U.S. history classes. So, Robert, you think that World War I is an important war, and in fact, you said that you've got a video coming out on your channel. As soon as we finish, you're going to get the upload going. That's called The Long Shadow of World War I, if I'm not mistaken. So, Robert, why is it that you believe that World War I is so important and something that perhaps deserves a bit more attention on, in our classrooms?
Well, I would like to agree with you that it is very overshadowed, and that is why. Plus, the United States was only in it for a year or so. It's not near like what you see with World War II, that's for sure. But I called it the long shadow because of all the ramifications of it. It was kind of the end of the 19th century and those glory, that golden age that I'm going to stress quite a bit in this video that's coming out tomorrow. But also just the ramifications of what happened with the 20th century. I mean, we all know how it set up World War II perfectly. But you've got the creation of the League of Nations, which collapses. That's the inspiration for the United Nations later, which basically is trying to control the world now. You've also got the British, which is completely overlooked. I mean, the British, with the destruction of the Ottoman Empire, the British occupation of Palestine, later transferring over to create the State of Israel, that pretty much set up the modern Middle East as we see it now. When they carved up the Ottoman Empire, what they did to the Middle East. And then you've got the size of government and the way it grew to just unforeseen, in all of the countries involved that survived, the amount of government power there, getting off of the gold standard, the creation of fiat currency, just printing money for the sake of printing it, to pay for everything because they did not have the money to pay for that war. The overreach with stuff like what you see in World War I and World War II with the war production boards, literally seizing control of manufacturing and what they did with the country's resources, funneling them all into the war effort. I think when you look at it all, not to mention the Bolsheviks, I mean, my goodness. The creation of the first communist state, that sets up the entire Cold War later, which leads to the military-industrial complex, which leads to U.S. troops all over the world today. I think you put it all together, the big picture. I mean, it's what sets up the entire 20th century.
Okay, well, yeah. Now, you've mentioned a lot of stuff, Robert. We might want to kind of tackle some of those bit by bit. One thing that a lot of people, and I was actually listening to Dr. Marks, who's a historian at Clemson University, and he was actually giving a talk to my class and explaining how, especially with the Russian Revolution, as far as that being a creature of World War I, that, of course, the popular story, what most people kind of think about is that Russia was already on its last legs, that it was inevitable that the czarist regime in Russia was on the verge of collapse. But really, while there are a lot of reasons somebody could argue for that, he mentioned, for example, like you mentioned the currency and the banking systems, that before World War I, Russia had a very stable banking system. And so as far as that goes, there are things that, you know, World War I was a very disrupting, you know, influence on that. And without that going on, and I believe what was it, the Germans that got Lenin, they said, yes, hey, why don't you get on this train? We're going to give
here's
you some money because
million,
we
want 50 million.
Yeah. So here's some money and go over there and do your thing.
Freight
and
lines,
without World
War trains full of weapons. Yes.
Yeah, so as far as that goes, first of all, the Russian Revolution. So no World War I, no Cold War as we know it, no Soviet Union as we know it.
That's creation of Israel.
Okay, maybe. So the Middle East. Okay, now what's one topic that you want to kind of get on and discuss in particular?
Any of them you would wish. I mean, are your students? There's some people watching. If they want to choose, I've got just the irony of how it seems unavoidable when you're teaching it, going up into it. It seems like with the militarism, the nationalism, the other ism, you know, imperialism, militarism, nationalism, alliances, it seems unavoidable going in, but then you look at it in retrospect, you're like, what the heck were they doing? Certainly U.S. involvement in the war, we could discuss that. But I would like to talk about how they, you know, why these soldiers chose to fight. This was a volunteer army, by and large, at the beginning. Britain, like 2.5 million men ran to join. We could talk about why, what was going on in their school systems prior to that. It's pretty interesting.
Now, that would be interesting. Like, if we go into the why of World War I, the causes and such, because I know that, I haven't looked at everything that was said during today's ceremony, but I know that President Macron in France, he said something about nationalism and how some of the old demons are coming back to haunt us. And
you know, you
so
don't agree
as far
with him, you're a demon, you know.
Well, and I guess that's what a lot of those politicians say to some extent or another. But so as far as that is concerned, what is this when we're talking about nationalism, World War I, and you're talking about the schools? Tell me about that.
Well, I was looking into it, trying to figure out, because I went through a lot of different sources, because for about 2 weeks, I was like, I've got to do something, try and think of some different way of looking at it. And you know, you can look at how much of the West was wasted on this war, just all the prosperity of the entire, really from the end of the Napoleonic Wars. I mean, am I mistaken? I was sitting here trying to think. You had the Napoleonic Wars, those were huge. You had armies of 400,000-500,000 men. Those are pretty large. But then after that, you've got the Crimean War, you've got the Franco-Prussian War, a couple of other little ones. There's a really big gap between the big wars of the early teens, to World War I, right? It's a pretty
long
period of peace. So I was like, am I overlooking something? I was like, the Crimean War, you've got the Franco-Prussian War. Were there any other big... And even calling Franco-Prussian War a big war is really not. I mean, there's the Austrian War, you know, with Prussia. But that was what, one day?
That's like, certainly not a continental war. I mean, the closest you'd come to a continental war would be the Crimean War, which, of course, is fought really kind of off the, you know, on the outskirts of the European continent, really. It would be safe to say that... you know, yeah, there's not a major, you know, a conflict on the magnitude of the Napoleonic Wars between that and World War One. I mean, the Crimean War, I think you're looking at about 500,000 dead, which is less than the American Civil War. So for a European war, was rather light. I remember Thomas Jefferson said in his one of his inaugural addresses, I believe it was the second, but he said that we are, you know, basically blessed to be separated by a wide ocean from what he called the exterminating havoc of one quarter of the globe. And so that was Thomas Jefferson looking over at Europe during the Napoleonic Wars, that certainly Europeans have a long history of killing each other. And so the Napoleonic Wars, of course, you had after that the concert of Europe with Metternich, and, you know, they set up a system where let's support each other and make sure, you know, not totally unlike what you had in the United States with the Constitution, that after Shays' Rebellion had occurred. It's like, well, let's set up a system to support each other in the case of something like this happening. And so between 1815 and 1848, you had this system, this concert system where, and of course, I've got my Austria shirt on while I'm talking about this.
I've got my eye.
Yeah, and so as far as that goes, you're dealing with a period of peace, and which is interrupted by a few things. Now, of course, German unification. We can look at the Austro-Prussian War and the Franco-Prussian War and what's going on with that as almost a prerequisite. Now, one thing that in my lecture on German unification, I go in the Franco-Prussian War. A lot of times we talk about what happened at the Treaty of Versailles, that France had to. Germany had to give up Alsace-Lorraine, and then there were the reparations, and then they signed the treaty in the Hall of Mirrors. But see, you go back to the Franco-Prussian War, and of course, Germany won that one. Well, they proclaimed the German Empire in the Hall of Mirrors. They went into Versailles and, you know, just kind of stuck it to the French and said, we're going to proclaim our empire here in the Hall of Mirrors. The French had to pay reparations to the Germans, and then France had to give up Alsace-Lorraine, which had been part of France from the time of Louis XIV. And so really, the Franco-Prussian War could be seen to have had like some of the seeds, at least as far as the Franco-German element of World War One. That was already there. I mean, France is like, hey, I know where we can sign this treaty. We can sign it in the Hall of Mirrors. So, as far as that is concerned, you know, you mentioned this period of peace. So what's responsible for starting World War One in your view?
Well, the childish behavior, I mean, you certainly need that of the governments and the tit for tat. I mean, you just said it. Hey, we sign it in the Treaty of, the Room of Mirrors. Well, we're going to do it here. Kind of like the trading back Alsace-Lorraine. It is, because I mentioned that in the video, that these wars, it's not a civilian endeavor. These are government endeavors. You need the governments to declare war on each other. You need the civilians to fight this large-scale war. So, I mean, I go through those things, but I also think to have the soldiers to actually fight, I mean, 2.5 million British lads say, hey, we're going to go off. In fact, they were giddy to do it. They were like, we're afraid this war is going to be over by the end of summer. I mean, we've got to get to it. Kind of like what you saw in the Civil War here. But I was like, where did they get that from? Why do you get, like, Oxford and Cambridge, all those guys that graduate? You know, why does, like, 97% of them decide, hey, we're going to go off and fight? You know, the ones who were graduating that year or previous years, what were they doing? And because those old wars, you could use a professional army, right? I mean, General Howe's army during the American Revolution, that 30,000 men, I mean, when they land at Long Island with 30,000 men, you know, several thousand of them are Hessians, that was a large army. That was the largest British invasion force ever up to that point, 30,000 men. How do you get from that to 65 million men? Now, obviously, we have the draft and such, but I was looking into the creation of the British school systems and the way they had remodeled them. During the 1860s, there was the threat of Napoleon III. And they were like, we have to be able to defend ourselves, because they were thinking, you know, a repeat of the Napoleonic Wars, whatever. So they kind of changed the way they did the British education system. during that era, they started sending their young men off to these schools, which were kind of ran like, the British boarding schools. The stories I read of them, you know, think of Oliver Twist and stuff like that. You know, sir, may I have some more? And they're just like, no. And the way they treated these kids was almost like a military school, the way they treated it. Very strict discipline, very, very, very harsh living conditions that they lived in. It was very well organized, but, you know, you're freezing in the barracks, you're suffering. Really, all you have to look forward to is the sporting events, the games. And, you know, sporting events, they can be fun. I mean, I don't know if you played football or something like that, but people always compare that to war. You know, sporting events, children, young boys love playing them, but they are highly competitive. It is that team, our team. You know, you can be differentiated by uniforms and stuff like that. So they set up their school systems in a very harsh military-like environment, very strict discipline, don't speak unless spoken to. And of course, what did they teach them in these places? They taught them that nationalism, that patriotism. They taught them versus us. They taught them loyalty to the king, loyalty to God, loyalty to country. And you had Otto von Bismarck kind of doing the same thing in the nationalistic Germany. I mean, whenever he set up the school systems, Germany was a brand new unified country. It's like, hey, you know, the British, they've had their empire. The Russians, they've had their empire. The French, they've had theirs. Well, we're now a new thing. We got to prove how great and strong we are. So those were kind of like microcosms of the country. And of course, these are going to be the young lads that have to fight the war later on. So when you start thinking about it, when the state takes over the education system, I mean, what did the United States of America's education system, what was it based on? The Prussian model. I mean, we've even got kindergarten. We even named it that. What do they do? You're drilling these young men to either do one of two things, work in the factories of the Industrial Revolution. And on one hand, you've got the factories of the Industrial Revolution. They're what created that great living standards that we have in the West now. It's what drastically improved the quality of life, but you could now mass produce stuff. You're either going to need the workers for those factories, or if need be, we're going to use them to go to war. You're going to follow orders, you're going to follow instructions, you're going to be together with your class, your unit, and if need be, you're going to go off to war. And I think they were probably learned that nationalism in there, you know, the patriotism, whatever you want to call it. I mean, what is nationalism but patriotism on steroids? So the government, the war, that is a machine of the government. But then again, so is the school system. That is a machine of the government. They're going to create in the school system the outcome that they want. I mean, whatever you are getting out of your school system, that's what the politicians actually want, because they're the ones who set it up and run it. So
yeah, now that's pretty fascinating, because I was actually talking to a teacher in the UK who, when I was describing, you know, what they do in the United States, that, you know, at every school we have the American flag. The American flag is in every classroom. The Pledge of Allegiance and all of that kind of stuff. Yeah. Now, and of course, I'm not saying that that's like a bad thing or anything like that. But what was interesting to me when I was talking to this British teacher, the British teacher told me, we don't do any of that. Like, usually on a school campus in Britain today, that it's not the norm to see a Union Jack, like, on the campus of the school or in the classroom. Now, of course, my friends in Texas, they've typically got not only the American flag, but also the Texas flag in their classroom. They've got two of them. So, you know, the thing is, yeah, that when it comes down to it, you know, the Prussians were the ones who came up with this model for public education. And while you can certainly have public education, a democratic society, I think we do have to be honest with ourselves that, you know, the education system that we've got in the United States today was there to condition people to work in factories and, as you're saying, to go to war when it's time. Now, the fascinating thing, and I'm sure historians have looked at this, and it sounds like maybe I've heard something like this before, but the The movement of athletics from like personal fitness and individual sports to these team sports, that this is actually happening in the late 19th century. I was actually at the Biltmore House when I was over the summer. And what was interesting to me is when I looked in, they had like a gym, a fitness center, workout room kind of thing. And they had these Indian clubs, like they call them Indian clubs, but you swing them around, they can have a certain weight, and it's something that can help your flexibility and muscles and whatever. But when I was reading about this, I mean, I recognize these things at the Biltmore House, but what happened is that you're moving away, like, you know, in the late 19th, early 20th century, you're actually moving away from stuff like this. And of course, I think like Teddy Roosevelt, you know, took up boxing, horseback riding, all of that kind of stuff that's individual. But then you start to see like, well, here's baseball,
football,
your team. Yeah, baseball, football, your team. Yeah, it's like your team is going against this other team, and the whole idea of the crowd, like just that, you know, the crowd is there. And of course, that's still something that we, you know, we celebrate today when you go to the ball game. It's like you root for the home team, right? And so it's like these are our fans, those are their fans. And, you know, you make a snide remark about someone that's wearing the other thing. So, you know, the and as I'm saying, I'm sure historians have looked at this connection, but it's still very compelling to think about like this very, like the first, like, you know, really truly modern war with, you know, driven by volunteerism, nationalism, is in this era that is about, you know, that is bringing about team sports. And of course, when we talk about like the shadow of World War One, that today, I mean, I was explaining to somebody from another country about how in the United States, we have actually 2 days of football. During football season, every weekend we have Saturday for college football, Sunday for pro football. Yeah, so there are some people that are into all three, that they'll have 3 days of football. Of course, I typically watch Clemson and kind of keep it at that. But yeah, we've got high school, college, and professional football. So all of these team sports, they were coming around at this time in the late 19th, early 20th century. Fascinating, Robert.
When you think about the way the sports are organized, and even in those British schools, those boarding schools I read about, I mean, you're trained to endure pain and suffering without crying, complaining. You're trained to follow orders, do what you're told to do. It kind of is a prelude to war. I mean, a lot of Native American tribes did that with their games. Sometimes they would play their very violent, you know, the ball game as a substitute for war.
And really, this goes all the way back to the ancient Greeks and Romans. You look at all of the sports that they, you know, the javelin, discus, running, and boxing. Yeah, wrestling. It's like all of these things were conditioning young men to fight in wars. And so, yeah, that's our sports today. And of course, yeah, especially the really like intense ones. I mean, in America, I mean, I love baseball, but you know, certainly football has become our spectator sport of choice in the United States, and it's the one of all of those sports that came about. It's the roughest.
Yeah, it's the most, you know, I don't want to use the word violent. I love it, but I mean, we know with the concussions and the injuries and just how dangerous that sport actually is. The other thing I touched upon in that video about why these young men went off to fight was the societal pressures that you get from people. And probably the most ironic of them all is the fact that, at least in Britain, because it's the one I've read about the most, the feminists at the time of World War One were pro-war. The women in that country were very pro-war, very patriotic. I mean, you've probably heard of the white feathers that the women carried around in Britain, I would assume. It's one of those things where, you know, a chicken feather, a white feather, where they would march around, and if they saw a young man who was not in military uniform, they would actually walk up to him and present him with the feather. Like, you're a chicken, you're a coward for not wanting to fight. And think about the social pressures of men, you know, trying to impress women. Or a lot of guys are attracted to that, you know, because it's, oh, the women, you know, they'd wave their hankies and they would cheer the young men off, and you'd have your parades and they would fly the flags and stuff like that. when you had the women of the society chastising you if you did not join up. I mean, that is an awful lot of societal pressure placed on you as well. Because no one wants to be thought of as a coward.
Yeah, that's very interesting, because it sounds like as well, you know, because you had the women's suffrage movement going on, and the war effort was in a lot of ways about, okay, whatever my factional grief is, I'm going to put that aside. Like you think about in the United States, Samuel Gompers and the American Federation of Labor, that we're not going to strike during a war because that would be unpatriotic, that it's time to put this aside. And to hear something like that going on, perhaps with the women's suffrage movement as well. And of course, you know, in Canada and in Europe especially, there are a lot of women who are working in those munitions factories. And that's another thing about World War One, is you start to see like this whole Victorian kind of idea of a woman on her pedestal, and now you've got this woman in the munitions factory.
Yeah, and she's doing posters. Something. You know, they're women are doing this for the country, now you need to go fight. You know,
yeah, now that stuff, was
how much more can this go on where you see trying to get U.S. in the war, the United States in the war, you know,
yeah, and the
women in all those posters.
Oh, yeah, like there, when I'm showing off these propaganda posters, you've got one where a woman says, if I were a man, I'd join the Navy. And so it's got that underlying kind of thing where that message that, okay, even a woman, if she were able to enlist, she would. And so therefore, if you're a man and you haven't enlisted, then what's wrong with you?
You have to.
And yeah, and I think one of my favorite ones, it's got one of those dogs that's, you know, running to do whatever those dogs were doing in the war. And the poster says, even a dog enlists.
Yeah.
Why not you?
The little messenger
and
dogs.
Right. As if the dog just kind of made a voluntary, hey, I'm ready
join.
Right. So, you know, with that as well, what would be another way, Robert, that you would say that World War One has continued to really had a lasting effect on Western culture in general?
The growth of government power, the printing of fiat currency. The United States managed to stay on the gold standard. Of course, we weren't in it for very long, but all those countries in Western Europe, you know, they got rid of it. Because they just simply could not print enough money to and back it up. So that, the growth of government power, the way they seized control of the factories and said, we're going to start producing this stuff. Even the stupid daylight savings time. We got that because of World War One.
That's a World War One thing.
Yeah, they definitely started doing it during the war. To keep the factories going longer so we'd have an extra hour of daylight. So they started doing that during the war, and we just kind of like never stopped doing it. So that's kind of crazy.
Okay.
But I would definitely say to fund the war, to stop paying your bills, to just print that money, borrowing insane amounts of money. It's like they never stopped doing that after the war was over. Because you had to pay for all that stuff. I mean, 65 million soldiers, feeding them, clothing them. I just try to explain to my students, imagine we sent over about 1.4 million soldiers. Just imagine the effort and cost of just feeding those men for one day. How difficult that would be. Not to mention the bullets, the shells, the canisters, the artillery pieces, the weapons of war, the tools of war as far as trucks, vehicles, tanks, motorcycles. Getting all that stuff over there is insane. And I don't think I'm not into the big government conspiracy like, oh, they were planning on getting us into the war. But we know when we got the income tax, right? I mean, when the United States went back.
Yeah, now. Now, of course, the thing is that it sounds like the United States was actually ahead of the game that you're talking about here, because the Federal Reserve, that's at the beginning of Woodrow Wilson's presidency, and as well as the income tax. Yes. Now, of course, the income tax was instituted in 1913, 14. But the thing is, the way that they got people to agree to the income tax is this is only going to be taxing the rich. Like, mm-hmm. the average person isn't going to pay anything. And at first, that was true. And really, the top tax bracket, it was around 7%. 7%.
Yep.
7%. And then World War One hits, and, you know, it just, woo!
Oh,
but
just
then again,
AP.
Yeah, now what's interesting about that, though, is that, of course, you know, when you read histories of the 1920s, there are a lot of people. I saw it on an exam question for AP US History that Andrew Mellon, the Secretary of Treasury in the 1920s, oversaw tax cuts for the rich. And the thing is, if you look at World War One, okay, if you look at those levels, it's like, okay, so the top tax bracket went down from 75% to 25%. But then why was the tax at 75% anyway? So if you take out the war and the ridiculously high taxes that they put up during
the
war,
they tried to make like normal.
Yeah, that see that after so when you compare it to before the war and then after the war, the top tax bracket was actually the only tax bracket that was paying more taxes, higher taxes in the 1920s than they were paying before World War One. Everybody else during the 1920s was paying a lower tax rate than they'd been paying before the war. But it's just during the war thing. I mean, I don't think that there's anybody. I don't think even Bernie Sanders suggested a 75% tax rate. I think that
Britain made it to 97%.
Yeah, and of course, that was even the case, you know, in the 60s. The Beatles, you know, wrote that song Taxman about that. But then again, you know, this is the thing that you look at before World War One. You really had the heyday of classical liberalism. And, you know, you had both, you know, Gladstone and Disraeli, that both of the parties in the UK opposing the income tax. And of course, in the United States, there wasn't an income tax. I mean, some of this is kind of, you know, you look at women's suffrage, and of course, that can be seen as a legacy of World War One, but then it's already going on in some countries before World War One. So when you look at it from that perspective, you know, the United States has already devised some central, you know, the central banking and the very creative ways of borrowing and financing debt were already known before the war, but the war was kind of the first time for everybody, I suppose, to really put those ideas into, you know, into practice, these things
like
that had just gotten
there.
They
took the concept of the Industrial Revolution and just transferred it over to government. It's like, hey, here's how we can mass produce debt and get away with it and cover it up and move and shift money around and stuff like that. So it was about a 7% tax rate. About 2% of the people paid it in the United States of America before the war. Then, of course, we get in the war and they literally just change it. It jumps all the way up to, I mean, you said it. I'm impressed you knew that. It was right at 77%.
Yeah, it was pretty pretty high, but you know, of course, today they just take it out of our checks and we don't even see it.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that if people actually had to fork over the money, then they might feel a bit differently. I mean, I think if I'm not mistaken, I mean, I know I'm not mistaken on this, but I don't know what the actual figures are, but they are our ancestors, forefathers, and mothers who protested during the American Revolution, like the Stamp Act and the Sugar
Act
and all of that kind of stuff. Yeah, that those taxes were just, they were almost nothing compared to what we pay today. So certainly, like, now, of course, there have been a lot of intervening things, such as the Cold War, the Great Depression, and that sort of thing. But yeah, World War One tested the power of government. Like, you couldn't fight that war with these limited governments of the 19th century,
well,
like you had in the United States
and
Britain.
And if you opposed the tax, well, you were unpatriotic. So you couldn't really speak out against it, or they would just throw that up in your face. I mean, I've even heard people today say, oh, paying your taxes is a patriotic duty. And I'm like, yeah, well, if I could pick where my money went, but I have no say in that. But during these wars, you could not oppose it. You could not speak out against it, or you'd be unpatriotic. Heck, in the United States, we had the Sedition Acts and stuff. You know, they would throw you in jail for opposing the draft. I mean, could they do that for opposing the income tax or saying my taxes are too high?
Well, you know, what's interesting is that, yeah, that Espionage and Sedition Act, there was one time I read the whole thing and I thought, wow, some of the stuff that's in there, displaying the German flag at that time, like during World War One, if somebody were to display the German flag, then that's a crime. Now, of course, I don't know how many people, you know, we know that Eugene V. Debs got arrested for resisting the draft and such. I don't know if anybody got arrested for displaying a German flag. That'd be kind of a gross violation of the First Amendment. It's kind of like the, you know, my state and several other states have laws against ballot selfies and such. And so I tweeted a picture of my ballot and my friends warned me. They said, you know, that's illegal. And I'm thinking, are they really going to come arrest me for that? You know, kind of like I'm
going
to show
who
50.
You voted for. Was it before?
Yeah,
or after?
Yeah. Most. Yeah, it was after. It was after. And most of them were write-ins anyway. So yeah. Either write-ins or elections that are either contested or, I mean, uncontested or virtually uncontested. Yeah. But that is that's something. And another thing I would think, especially given elections, you know, this is really a time where, you know, this is the first war, like the first real major war that comes about with, you know, after the maturity of democracy. If you think about it, you know, because you go back to the Napoleonic Wars, I mean, democracy is certainly not a thing. And of course, that's something that, you know, people have said about the Paris peace talks, the Treaty of Versailles, that after the Napoleonic Wars, the elites were able to get together and they were able to say, okay, well, let's do, you know, this, and this, and we can do, you know, it'd be best to do it this way, and we don't want to punish France, and we're going to create this, you know, this system. But then after World War One, you've got to account to the people. And your people, you know, especially if you're in France, like, I believe that for every American that was killed in World War One, you had 8 Brits and 12 and a half Frenchmen. That's really, and then those countries are smaller than we are as well. And so those countries, they had experienced a lot, kind of like you're talking about where General Howe shows up with 30,000 troops on Long Island. And we're looking at that sort of thing. I mean, if we look at, let's just take a look at Verdun and just to look. So we've got, you know, and then of course, like a battle that lasts, yeah. a single battle that lasts from February to December. And so you've
and
got here
in the French countryside. I mean, there's towns and villages wrapped up in the battle lines.
Yeah, that you've got 300,000 people killed in this battle. So not, you know, so when you're thinking about that, 300,000 people, like half the people killed in that 10-month battle as were killed in the entire American Civil War.
Yep. And it's, as I said, it's all intertwined along the French countryside. I mean, there's French villages that I know of, at least 5 French villages or towns that just, they disappeared during the war. The battle literally just engulfed them. They left as refugees and never came back. There's just markers in the middle of the French countryside that say this is where this village was. Even up at the time of World War II, you still had people. I mean, if you were farming in France, every time you took your plow and you buried it down in the soil, you didn't know if you were going to hit some undetonated explosive that's just going to take your leg off. I mean, I can understand France's... People make fun of France. People, oh, they're sissies, they don't want to fight, or, you know, jokes about the French surrender, like, hey, here's a French rifle, never fired, was dropped once. Mm-hmm. And when they were running off, but I can understand their reluctancy at World War II and even the reluctancy today of never go through something like that again.
It's yeah, and of course that
trauma, not just for the people that lived, but it continues on today, even though no one alive today went through it. It's in the country's psyche.
Yeah, and of course, you go back to, I mean, a lot of times looking back, it's just, why didn't Britain and France take a harder line with Hitler? And they really didn't want this to happen again. So, of course, we call this Veterans Day in the United States. But then if you go back to, you know, before World War II, and of course, even today, Armistice Day. And excuse me, there's something I might do a talk or a video about this. Stanley Baldwin, who was the British prime minister through much of the 1930s, he gave a speech one time. The prime minister always gave a speech on Armistice Day, but he gave a speech called "The Bomber Will Always Get Through." Now, of course, now we've got radar, but what he's talking about is, you know, we think like he was, and people have actually debated some of the meaning of this speech, like what exactly was he trying to get at. But when he said the bomber will always get through, that there's going to be, we're doing all of these things to prevent another war, but he's starting to see that that's probably not going to happy, you know, that we're resting on our laurels, and, you know, no matter what we do to prevent another war, something's going to happen, or no matter what military technology we create, something's going to go around it. So in the 1930s, they're starting to kind of see, well, maybe this war to end all wars, maybe it won't be the last one. Now, of course, thank God we haven't had another conflict of the scale of World War II since then, but who knows? I mean, I've always told people that nuclear weapons are, you know, they've been a great thing for us because they prevented war.
Yeah, even the atheistic communist. I mean, yeah, but they're like, okay, this is our one life, that's it. You get it in the right hands of the wrong people, the wrong regime, it's a totally different story if they're like, hey, we're bringing about the end of the world because it's our duty. But it worked with the Soviet Union for sure.
Well, yeah, they're rational operators, and of course, you know, you never know who's going to get a hold of these things, but so far, you know, they've been great for us. Now, until they're not. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's kind of like the alliance system. You know, it was supposed to prevent the war.
It prevented war for a long time until it didn't.
Until it didn't. And of course, the thing is, if we look at it today, we're part of NATO, and, you know, so far, nobody wants to mess with NATO. That's a pretty big alliance. Of course, the United States counts for a lot of that. But anyway, Robert, you know, I just wanted to thank you for coming on the program tonight, yeah, and for chatting with me. And of course, Robert, you can find him on YouTube at Reading Through History. He's also got a pretty good Teachers Pay Teacher store. It's bigger than mine. He does not only YouTube videos, but he's created a lot of informational text and things for people
workbooks
to read and follow along with. Okay, so he's on Amazon as well. So if you search for Reading Through History, we've been joined today by Robert Marshall. And Robert, I look forward to checking out your video once that uploads, and we will be
as soon as I can.
Observing Veterans Day in this country formally tomorrow, even though today is technically 11/11. So again, Robert, thanks a bunch, and hopefully I'll talk to you again sometime.
All right, thanks for having me.